All right, thank you. All have seats. The first case that we're going to be hearing this afternoon is the Regional Transportation District versus 750 West 48th Avenue. Could I have the entry of appearances, please?
Good afternoon, Robert Duncan of the law firm of Robert and Duncan LLC.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. For the property.
Good afternoon, Jody Alderman of Alderman Burns.
Thank you. You'll see this case is set for 1 hour. That means that you each have a half an hour. And Mr. Duncan, if you wish to reserve some time, you should do so yourself. It's easy to tell how much time you have just by looking when you put it in the mail. So whenever you're ready, you may go ahead and proceed, Mr. Duncan.
Chief Justice Rice and members of the court, good afternoon and thank you for your time. My name is Robert R. Duncan of the law firm of Robert R. Duncan, LLC, and I'm representing a petitioner of the Regional Transportation District in this case. This court accepted RTD's certiorari petition on two issues. Your decision regarding these issues will give guidance and clarification to lawyers who practice in the field of eminent domain, but also to all civil practitioners, especially those in civil litigation. One of the issues before you has been acknowledged by the Colorado Court of Appeals not to have a final ruling at the Colorado Appellate Courts. Colorado Court of Appeals ruled on it, but it's been appealed. That'll be before you today. For lawyers practicing in the field of eminent domain, your clarification and your guidance will be with regard to the interplay between the trial court, the trial court with which the petition condemnation is filed, and the evaluation commission or the commission that was appointed by the trial court in this case to hear the issue of just compensation. Specifically, you'll be asked, can a commission appointed by that trial court overturn court's order? The court's order was made pursuant to an in-limine motion and briefing. This is the issue that has not yet been decided in the state of Colorado at the final time of the appellate. Secondly, the issue is, can a court overrule a commission's determination of admitting evidence by issuing an instruction at the close of the case solely with regard to that piece of evidence? At an eminent domain proceeding, the commission typically does not preside. In the Vail case, discusses this, the Vail versus Shule office in the briefing, but typically a commission conducts an evaluation hearing without the presence of the judge. The judge will be present on the front end for pretrial rulings and the usual pretrial activities in any case, and the judge is there at the back end to issue the instructions and to accept and then review the, in this case, the certificate of assessment and ascertainment. Should it be a jury trial requested, then the judge will preside as in every other case. In summary, RTD, the Regional Transportation District, is asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals on these two issues, to return the case to the Court of Appeals with instructions to have the case remanded to the district court for a new trial consistent with what we hope will be favorable rulings in this case. Eminent domain is a special statutory proceeding in the district court. And this court has long ago stated that it believes that the eminent domain statutes 38-1-101 and following are a complete system for determining just compensation. I will be focusing your attention on two of these statutes, 38-1-101-2A. 101-2A states that all questions and issues shall be determined by the court, except for compensation. And then we move down to 38-1-105-2, and the commissioners are told that it's their job to determine just compensation according to the Colorado Rules of Evidence. The statute specifically gives power to the commissioners to hear the evidence and to make rulings. The statute also gives the commissioners the opportunity to call in a trial judge to clarify a ruling or to handle a particularly difficult issue, but the commission is not required to call in the trial judge. In this case, the evidence is, or the circumstances are, the trial judge appointed the commission. The commission tried the case without the trial judge present. The commission never asked the trial judge to be present. and to be present until the instructions were issued. The landowner requested a commission of three freeholders be appointed to determine the amount of just compensation. RPD had filed a petition in condemnation in Denver District Court to acquire property from the landowner, seven, which is known as 750 West 48th Avenue LLC, for its Fast Tracks project. This is a full taking of property. Consequently, there is no remainder. There's no issue of damages or benefits to the remainder. It's a full taking. So in this instance, just compensation equals the market value of the property. There was a trial as usual. The judge did not preside. RTD asserts there were several reversible errors committed by the commission and the court during the trial of this matter. These three issues were appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals upheld the trial court, and then RTD sought review from this court. Two issues were granted. First, whether the Court of Appeals erred in allowing the Eminent Domain Evaluation Commission to reverse trial court's inherently legal ruling and exclude evidence. Second, whether the Court of Appeals erred in ruling that the judge, who did not preside at trial, did not hear the evidence, could issue an instruction excluding a specific item of evidence that the Eminent Domain Evaluation Commission had ruled relevant and admissible. So we have the situation involves commission ruling, illegal ruling, and then the court, in essence, nullifying a factual finding by the commission. It's important that these matters, especially the first one, can the commission overturn a court that be resolved and policy be set.
Mr. Dunn, can I ask you a procedural question? Good afternoon.
Yes.
If we reverse and send back to the Court of Appeals, the underlying evidentiary questions, were those resolved? Or do they need to reconsider the underlying evidentiary issues? Because I don't think those are before us, correct?
That's correct. My next point here,
okay,
is not before this court.
I try to be a foil.
It is not before this court whether the trial court's order resulting from the motion to eliminate was correct. Neither party appealed this at all, so it wouldn't be at the Court of Appeals. Likewise, it is not before this court if the commission was correct in admitting what is known as the Willow Street evidence. Neither party appealed that finding. So those aren't before you or the Court of Appeals. This ruling would set policy in this matter of first impression. It will also help to eliminate what I might call some litigation mischief, where a party requests a ruling from a judge, obtains a ruling from the judge, and then goes to the commission to complain about the ruling and have the commission overrule it. I'd like to believe that a motion to eliminate a fine, but we need some guidance. Is that permissible?
Well, let me just interject there. Why would ruling on a motion in limine ever be filed? I mean, often when judges preside over the entire proceeding, a motion in limine maybe ruled on one way at the outset, but things may evolve in a way that causes the fact finder to decide that it needs to be heard, or the judge who's presiding over it might decide that it needs to be heard. Things change.
Justice,
trials are a very fluid process. Go ahead.
I'm aware of that. I'll just skip forward a couple of pages. Motions in limine have been used in Colorado since the late 1800s. The orders pursuant to a motion in limine are final. They're not provisional orders. Motion in limine is preliminary. It's a motion made at the preliminary portion of the proceedings. Okay, but an order, a pretrial order, is final, just like an order during trial is final, just like an order post-trial is final. There is no difference among orders pursuant to the manner in which the order is given.
Okay, Well, were to accept that, right, this is an evidentiary determination. How does it constitute a determination of law, which should really be the purview of the judge in this instance? So help me with that.
Yes, whether certain evidence is relevant or not in a case, it can be presented to a court pre-trial. Also, for instance, a classic is probably a Shrek down there hearing, where the court decides whether evidence can come in or not. In this instance, the motion in limine was presented to the trial court. The trial court, you'll see from some of the cases we cited, declined to hear a motion in limine that may be classified as denying a motion in limine, but they're really deferring it to the evaluation commission. In this instance, the court said that it would rule It received evidence through exhibits. It was briefing. There was no oral argument. And then the court issued an order for a ruling. And some of that was in favor of the landowner, some of that was not in favor of the landowner.
And it made a rather terse ruling regarding 702 and 403, right?
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering whether, under the statute, that really constitutes a determination of law that should be reserved to the trial judge, or if it's something that, under 105, the commissioner should be allowed to revisit, given the hybrid nature of the responsibilities.
I believe the commission cannot revisit a court order, but if the commission can revisit, just like any judge is not bound by his or her order in perpetuity, obviously things do change. In this circumstance, the order was given by the court on the Friday before the Monday trial. So, but if there are proper grounds, is what the law says, to overrule or change or modify that same judge or a successor judge, proper grounds simply stated, changing facts, changing law, or circumstances have made the ruling manifestly unfair, then a ruling can be revisited. But in this instance, the judge was not asked to revisit the ruling. And in this instance, the motion in limine order, the order issued pursuant to the motion in limine, was overturned by the commission, the former Judge Mays, without reading the order, without reading the briefing, without consulting with the court. So respectfully submit that even if the commission had the authority, which we don't believe it does, to overturn a court order, because it's a subordinate judicial body, it didn't take the proper steps to do so. Obviously, we try cases, the law of cases is very important. When a judge issues an order, you tend to follow it. If we don't like it, we'll ask to revisit it, a motion for reconsideration, and usually it's upheld. But in trying a case, the judicial mischief here is, if any order can be revisited at any time for any reason, then you have judicial mischief. I won't call it judicial chaos, but it's hard work to try cases and compare. It would be harder still if every time a judge issued an order, you couldn't rely on it necessarily. And that's what the clarification we're asking for.
And then what? I apologize. No, without wasting your time.
Judge,
so. Tell us about the juncture at which former Judge Naves decided to revisit that ruling by Frick.
It was in RTE's case. If you're not familiar with eminent domain cases, the landowner has burden of proof to go forward. And so the landowner had completed his case. We were in our case. We had a witness, Steve Serrain, an industrial real estate broker. We also had an appraiser, they had an appraiser. We thought because of the issues in this case that having a real estate broker, somebody with real life experience and knows how what properties, industrial properties trade for in Northwest Denver, and I'll get there, was going to testify as to certain issues by law that we believed had been approved by the trial court by denying the motion to preclude them. I offered the witnesses for those purposes. There was an objection by counsel. There was some discussion, and Justice Mays said that he said something peculiar. He didn't, in hindsight, in the transcript, he said, I don't necessarily want to overrule the trial judge, but that's exactly what he did.
But didn't this crop up on redirect and his rebuttal testimony, was it not?
Well, no, this is on direct testimony of our witness, Mr. Serrain.
All right. That's what I was struggling to read.
We call that the Serrain evidence. I think you may be mixing and matching
with the second.
The Wills.
Right, exactly. Okay, that's what I was trying to read.
Okay, yes, the property is located at 750 West 48th Avenue in an industrial part of Denver. It's owned by 750 West 48th Avenue LLC, which is owned by Jack and I believe Mary Lou Rob. There was a tenant, it was AAA Waterproofing, which was also owned by Jack and Mary Lou Rob. Different legal entities, same persons. The two appraisers agreed that the highest and best use for this property was as improved industrial property. This was an owner-occupied property, and the crux of the case was the super adequate finish it had, and whether that had value in the marketplace, and that's why Mr. Serrain, the industrial real estate broker, was there. Both appraisers used the cost method of appraising, which is there are three accepted methods of cost, the income of comparable sales. Cost and expenses are basis for esoteric cases. In the real world, people look at comparable sales. How much did that house cost? I'm going to pay this at this house. Or for industrial properties, it's usually income. How much can I make from it? The super adequate finish for the industrial use included cherry wood finish, granite flooring, steam shower, sauna, fitness room, executive suite, sleeping area, atrium. Wonderful amenities, but would they have any value in the marketplace? For example, the senior couple was a two-story home and maybe some extra money, might want to stay there and have an elevator installed in their home. Unusual, but they might want to do it. The value in the marketplace to that super adequate finish is probably zero, if minus. My wife and I at one time had three small children, they've grown, but if we had three small children, we would move into a house with an elevator. Because if they're talking about mischief, that would be a terrific problem. And so there's one real world expert, Steve Cerenni, our industrial real estate broker, to give some clarification to how this would be viewed in the marketplace and how it might be bad. And so that's what, so that's how that came about.
Well, why don't you contrast that with the Willow Street then, since
yes, and
there does seem to be
Willow
some confusion.
Involved questions about the relocation of the AAA waterproofing business to Willow Street property. On direct examination, counsel asked of the witness questions about relocation. Jack Ryan, the owner, quote, "And when you were forced to relocate your business, did you go out into the market?" That was a question asked by counsel. And later, "And when you moved your business, that wasn't your choice, was it, sir?" The door was open to talk about relocation. And so on cross-examination of Mr. Ryan, questions were elicited about this, that the Willow Street property didn't have super adequate finishes, but they could operate their business successfully at the Willow Street property without the super adequate finishes, and then we were trying to show that in the marketplace, those super adequate finishes would have little to no value. And that was important. There was the commission received an objection to our questions about the Willow Street property. It was overruled in part because Commissioner Day said that this was within the scope of the direct examination. Our cross-examination continued. There was another objection by counsel with regard to the line of questioning involving the Willow Street evidence, and again, Chairman Mays said that the commission wanted to give that evidence. Counsel argues to this court now that nothing about relocation should ever come into an eminent domain proceeding, citing the Washington manufacturing case. First, they opened the door, so nothing about per se can complain, in our opinion. Washington manufacturing case is a Durant Denver renewal case from the 70s, and Counsel Wayne Schroeder, remember Counsel Schroeder, was very clever in getting what appeared to be perhaps a double payment. In any event, the rule is that in eminent domain cases, you cannot subtract amounts paid to relocate the property. They're two separate things. We submit that the existence of the property being relocated in this instance was germane and relevant, and in fact, the opposing counsel opened the door to it.
But that's true because of the super adequacy concern.
Correct.
Right? And so, can you address the opposing argument that it's harmless error if it's error at all?
Yes.
Because I found myself struggling with that by the time I finished the reply period.
Yes. That's in here. Error. We call it error. It was error. When you try a case, the perception of error and harmless error is very different. First,
well, I guess there seems to, at least their contention is that there was abundant evidence on super adequacy that was otherwise provided, admitted even. So it sort of renders superfluous this evidence that ultimately Judge Frick instructed the commissioners to disregard, if I'm understanding it correctly. So,
right.
So address that.
Yes. First, with regard to the Willow Street, we believe that when the instruction Judge Frick gave was not a matter of law. It was an instruction on evidence. Judge Frick, there was no law on that instruction. And so we believe the standard of review is, first of all, does an instruction correctly set forth the status of Colorado law. That instruction did not. Didn't have anything to do with Colorado law. And then you move to, so we think that instruction was improper from that perspective. However, the point I'm getting to here is that the commission, not once but twice, said we want to hear that evidence. That's within the commission's purview. 38-1-105-2 says the commission is supposed to pursue it to the rules of evidence. The judge doesn't have the authority to pop into a case at the end when it hasn't heard any of the evidence, hasn't heard any of the circumstances, and issue a ruling. And that precise circumstance, we submit, is in the Jefferson Center case on page 499. And in Jefferson Center, it said it's not possible to determine what effect the Willow Street, we say the Willow Street evidence would have had on the commission's determination. Reversal is thus required. That's our position. We wanted to show the unique point that the business could operate successfully without the super adequacy of saw the agreement, etc. Therefore, those super adequacies would not have been in the marketplace, was our position.
But wasn't there expert testimony to that effect already on the table? Wasn't there other evidence that more than established that point that you wanted to make about super adequacy?
Well, it didn't establish it well enough from our perspective.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair response.
We don't think it was adequate. We wanted to process it. We thought the evidence from the owner would be the best evidence with regard to that point.
I understand.
With regard to the motion in limine, it's a little unusual, a little awkward. Of all the testimony that RTD was going to present, the opposing counsel decided that the evidence from Mr. Serenity was particularly damaging. All evidence should be prejudicial, but obviously they thought this would be unduly prejudicial to their side, and they tried to block it. The judge ruled for them, the judge ruled against it. Then they were so concerned about this evidence, they went to the commission and said, overrule the judge on this. The commission did. So now we have a situation with RTD. We agreed that motions in limine are final. Okay, we agreed. We agreed that the trial court could rule. And these were points that the trial court, opposing counsel suggested that motions in limine are to simplify the issue, shorten trial, avoid a mistrial. We agreed with all that. And opposing counsel was looking for an order to strike this testimony. And that order didn't came. They tried it again. The commission struck the testimony. Why is it the prejudicial? It was from Mr. Serenity, the unique witness, not an appraiser, the real estate broker. He makes his living buying and selling properties. And also, really, it's a fundamentally unfair situation where counsel seeks a ruling, gets a ruling, doesn't like the ruling, has the ruling overturned, and then says, well, it didn't matter, it's all harmless error. If it was so harmless, why don't you file the motion of limine in the first instance? In its opposition that an order is an order is an order.
Counsel, if I can interrupt you.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to wrestle with your opening comment about whatever decision we come up with here will offer guidance to eminent domain, perhaps the attorneys, and how these proceedings operate. And it seems to me that a lot of the same thing down for our interpretation of these statutory provisions about where that line falls between the obligations and responsibilities of the trial court and the obligations and responsibilities of the commission. For me, I'm wrestling with this premise that you seem to be operating from, or both sides seem to be operating from, about the commission's ability to make evidentiary rulings. And I wonder if you can help me clear that out from the text of the statute. I recognize that there are some court of appeals decisions that should have ruled in that fashion. I'm not aware of any decision from this court that has so ruled. But the commission has the power to make these evidentiary rulings, as opposed to the trial court, where the trial court's tasked with determining all issues other than compensation.
There are several cases.
Court of Appeals cases, right?
Supreme Court cases as well, that hold what I'm looking at.
Yes. Preston?
Well, it's the Denver Waste Transfer. Is that a court of, I believe that's a Court of Appeals case. That says that the commission determines evidence. The Jefferson Center Associates case, that was a Court of Appeals case as well, says that the commission is supposed to make evidentiary findings. I'd have to look at the rest of my cases here to see which ones they are.
And that's my point exactly. I guess I'm just wondering if that's something we need to consider in the middle.
If you wish, it would.
So maybe you can walk me through the statute and we can look at the language there that you think gives the commission that express power.
Yeah, well, 38.5.101.2.
Right, so I assume you're pointing to, they shall hear the proofs and allegations of the parties according to the rules of evidence.
Correct.
And so you're interpreting that language to mean that the commission gets to make a call about whether this evidence or that evidence comes in under the rules of evidence.
Yes, but there are certain things that upper level, if you will, with regard to what, pursuant to the common law, whether, for instance, security of access is admissible, whether in the Vail and Shuhawk cases, whether subdivided sales can be used to value non-subdivided property. Those cases, that's well established law, those cases decided on motions of limit with regard to what evidence can commit. Pre-trial rules happens all the time.
Sure. I'm still struggling, though, given your two arguments here about where that line needs to fall, when it's the commission's responsibility and when it's the court's responsibility. I mean, even this motion in limine concerning an evidentiary issue.
Yes. Well, it's our position that the court has the first chance to rule and can, as it has done in certain circumstances, entirely decline to accept the motion in limine and say, I, the court, believe that that should be decided by the commission.
And so it's your position then that when the trial court does that prior to trial in the context of a motion in limine that cannot be revisited unless the court itself revisits its own ruling?
That's correct. And further, there should be a bright line. If that happens, that's reversible error. Hmm.
Could I stay with that 1 second? Just because I'm not sure how that resolved. I do was a little concerned. At least I didn't do separate research, but in the cases you all cited, it appeared that only the Court of Appeals, even though it's for the last 30 years or something, has held that this language of these statutes allows the commission to make evidentiary rulings.
Right. Well, consistent with the statute.
Well, and so I guess the question, and I took it to be Justice Marcus's question, but at least it's mine. should we follow that reasoning? Is it that clear from the statute, and is that something that is in effect preliminary to both of these determinations, which is whether the commission has the power under the statute to make evidentiary rulings at all?
We believe the commission, no, we don't have to revisit. Two, it's not before this court, haven't agreed before this court, and those who may want to decide to be agreed. And we think that carrier practice in law since 1978, the Attorney General's office where I started, was believed.
Because the Court of Appeals has held that.
Justice Coates, Justice Marquez, I hadn't differentiated between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court with the rulings, but I'll.
And that's a very good distinction from our perspective.
Yes, I understand that. I'd like to reserve my time, but in closing, we'd like you to overrule the Court of Appeals on the two issues you accepted for certiorari. Return the case to the Court of Appeals, it to remand to the District Court for a trial consistent with your rulings. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Alderman?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jody Alderman of Alderman Bernstein, representing the landowner of 750 West 48th Avenue, LLC, which owned the property, a newly improved office warehouse building in Denver that was taken by RTD in this case. Jack Ryan and Mary Lou Ryan are the owners of the LLC, and Jack Ryan is also the owner of AAA Waterproofing, which was a tenant in the property that was relocated by RTD pursuant to the Federal Uniform Relocation Act to the Willow Street property, which we've been talking about today. Here, the two issues that RTD is arguing should be reversed. First, the first relates to the commission's authority to modify a trial court order, which in this case denied a motion in limine that sought to exclude testimony on relevancy grounds. And second, the trial court's issuance of an instruction to the commission not to consider evidence that was inadmissible as a matter of law was error. However, we urge this court to affirm both issues because the statutes and case law interpreting them do provide this authority. I want to go back to the last question, which is where that power arises of the commission. The Court of Appeals decisions have been quite clear that it comes under 38.1105, subsection 2 of the statute. And I think you have to read two parts of that statute together. The commission, and it's a big section that's down towards the middle of it, but the commission may request the court to make rulings upon the propriety of the proof or objections of the parties. And then the next section is, they shall hear the proofs and allegations of the parties according to the rules of evidence. And I think these two things together is where at least the Court of Appeals have very clearly said, if they don't ask the judge, they rule on evidentiary decisions during the course of the commission trial. I think also for Supreme Court cases, because I found that to be unusual. And the Court of Appeals cases have cited Vail Associates for that proposition, which is where the court said the judge doesn't have to sit there throughout the trial. And they also cited the Denver versus Berglund Chernin Company case for that. Now, in either of those cases, did I see that this was the issue on appeal? But they did generally stand for that position. So I think, as Mr. Duncan said, for however many years these statutes have been in place, this is how we've operated.
Right, and I looked at the Vail case, I didn't check the other one, but the Vail case didn't seem to be that express about that. I can understand maybe an inference might be drawn, but it didn't seem to say that expressly.
I think the next step from that case to get you to this point is when the judge sits, the commission then becomes just a jury rather than a combination of a jury and fact finder. So if the commission wasn't allowed to make evidentiary rulings and the judge sat through the case, then the provisions in the statute that permit an owner to select between a jury and a commission are meaningless. If that makes sense. I mean, then you really just have a jury trial in every case rather than the opportunity to have a commission trial. So I think it's a combination of all these things and that support the notion that they have that authority to start with. And then the question becomes, if the judge rules on an eliminating ruling, which Justice Fidji pointed out was based on an evidentiary ruling under 702 and 403, and it was a denial. It wasn't even an approval of that, and then a granting of that motion. It was a denial of the motion. It was an evidentiary ruling. So then, in that context, is where the commission in this case came in and said, in the context of the developed record and the evidence we've heard so far, which in this case was 3 days of testimony from appraisers, both real estate brokers for each side, factual witnesses, this was literally at the end of the third day of trial, the objection was raised that the average value of properties in Denver is not relevant. And the chair of the commission, retired Judge Naves, thought through this, just like we've briefed, and said, can I revisit this ruling? It's an eliminating ruling, those are provisional, I'm going to do it. And he held that he sustained the objection and kept the evidence out.
Could I ask you a broad question about the procedure, you all are right. I'm not real familiar with the eminent domain proceedings, and that's one of the reasons in construing the statute or understanding it. I think it's important for us to see how much problem we're going to create, depending on what we say. But in this case, you had a retired judge who was sitting on the commission, but that's not required.
That's correct.
That's right. And in fact, what is the makeup by statute of the commission?
The statute's only requirement is 3 freeholders, and they have to be impartial and unbiased.
And so there need not be a lawyer in the mix.
Sorry?
There need not be a lawyer in the mix.
There need not be a lawyer in the mix.
And the rule that the Court of Appeals has held, at least in construing this statute, as you point out, the parts in the 105.2, is that nevertheless, the commission, perhaps all non-lawyers, can rule on questions of evidence, on the admissibility of evidence. Is it not also a reasonable inference just from that language alone? Now, there may be other considerations here that made the Court of Appeals feel that was a necessary way to construe it, but simply from the words alone, is it not reasonable to say they will entertain, or what does it say, hear allegations based on rules of on the rules of evidence, and then it says they may ask the judge to rule on the evidence. Is it not also reasonable to understand that language to mean, and therefore if there's a question about the admissibility of evidence, they have to go ask the judge?
The statute does not say they have to, it says they may. And I think the cases that have looked at that have all decided that they can, but they don't have to again.
You're going back to Court of Appeals cases now, I take it on that, when you say the cases say they can, but they don't have to.
Let me think about that. There may be some...
Well, it has to be a judicial proceeding, right? Or at least quasi-judicial. That commission has got to be vested with adjudicatory authority, right?
The judge appoints the commission and does instruct them as to their duties as commissioners and tells them that they can make evidentiary rulings or ask the judge.
Sure, and then they can make decisions.
And they can make...
So it's like an administrative agency that is vested with quasi-adjudicatory authority and doesn't have a judge or lawyer necessarily on it, right?
There is no judge that has to preside, that's correct. The cases that I'm aware of have said they're a combination of judge and jury.
Yeah.
So at the moment they convene at the commission without a judge presiding, it is at that point their authority to make evidentiary rulings arises under the statute.
So what needs to be reviewed is the actual ruling that kept the evidence out as to whether or not it was justified under the law or not. Is that right? I mean, that would be subject to de novo review, would it not?
Well, if you were simply reviewing their evidentiary ruling, it would be an abuse of discretion.
Okay, abuse of discretion.
Correct, right. Yeah. Right.
But if it's a factual finding, it's deferential based on the record. So we're talking about a ruling that there was some discretionary authority to make that was vested in the commission.
I think that's correct. The commission has the discretion to make that ruling. And I think that the key to this case is to distinguish between a legal determination made pretrial and a limiting ruling made on a relevancy basis, because the statute does say the commission can make determinations on relevance under the rules of evidence, and there are a line of cases where that are rulings as a matter of law in trial, and Mr. Duncan started to talk about security of root. I think a standard one we have come up a lot is substantial impairment of access. And we have Supreme Court cases that say that goes to the judge pre-trial, there's a hearing, and that ruling is as a matter of law. That obviously is something that the commission does not have authority to review. And I think the list of non-compensable damages as a matter of law in the brief are also areas in which the commission doesn't have the authority to go back and review if a pre-trial ruling is made on that. View to the property is the Maryland Hickey case. There's a line of them, but substantial impairment of access is the one that I think is sort of the bright line rule over here of a question that's a matter of law that can't be revisited. And then I think the other bright line that this court could find is the denial of an in limine ruling on a relevancy objection should be able to be revisited by the commission in the context of the developed record in the court proceeding.
Ms. Alderman, can I follow up with your opposing counsel's argument if that's going to create chaos or mischief? Why do you file a motion in limine if it's going to be revisited? Doesn't that make the whole motion in limine a futile exercise?
Well, it may cause lawyers to not file in limine motions on relevancy issues and stick to pretrial rulings on matters of law like non-compensable damages. I would suggest that it wouldn't lead to chaos because there are examples of cases in practice over the years where this has happened. Denver Waste Transfer is one of those cases. There were two motions in limine filed. The judge denied both of them. One, he expressly said he left it to the commission.
That's different, right? There's no in what you're going to
But the other one, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's right. Go ahead.
The other one, he found that the evidence was relevant, yet once it went to the commission let some in and some out. So on that denial of the motion, the commission revisited it and decided what to do with the evidence in the context of the trial. So I think we have examples. That issue of authority hasn't been raised in these cases, but the cases show you examples of how that process works in real life and how we as practitioners are used to it.
And I apologize, I didn't mean to rush you there. but you kind of touched on the first one. The judge said, I'm going to leave it to the commission. So there's a notice component. What I'm concerned with is if a motion in limine is granted, people alter their trial strategy. They may or may not have a witness available. They may or may not ask questions. I mean, there has to be some degree of reliability on those motions in limine, do there not? That's what I'm concerned with in terms of that argument, the chaos resonating with me.
Right, and I think in terms of the context of this case on a denial of a motion in limine, nobody changed any of their status. Well, I don't know if people changed their strategy, but the witness was called and the evidence was offered and the objection was raised again as it would have been in a regular civil proceeding. So in our context, a denial of a relevancy objection, I don't get to the chaos hypothetical that Mr. Duncan raised.
So if, what would the holding be then, that we would enter an order that a motion in limine can be overruled by the commission if it's a denial of a motion in limine and witnesses are subsequently available?
Well, the way the statute reads and the authority of the commission in that it's related to rules of evidence, it's our position that the rule should be that if the in limine motion relates to an evidentiary objection, that can be revisited in the context of the developed trial record, just as it could be as a civil court judge sitting in the same case. If it's a ruling in limine as a matter of law, such as these damages are not compensable as a matter of law, you can't offer the evidence, that can't be revisited to the commission. That's where, from the case law and the statute, that's where I see the bright line rules falling.
All right, thank you.
In terms of the Willow Street instruction, this also shows how these cases sort of ebb and flow in condemnation, because in this proceeding, the Willow Street property evidence was offered, objections were made and were overruled, and then at the time of jury instructions, we asked the court to instruct the commission not to consider it on three grounds that it was inadmissible as a matter of law. And again, this does happen in these cases. If evidence comes in through the commission, which they didn't have the authority to admit, then you can go to the judge and ask for an instruction on the point. And I think it's the Iago case, which talked about that in some respects. And it says that the commission can consider any competent evidence that a buyer or seller would consider apart from those factors precluded by the court. I'm sorry, that goes back to the interview. These are very interrelated issues, because I think you're looking at matters of law with the court and evidentiary matters with the commission. So when you get to the instruction point and you have something that came in that was inadmissible as a matter of law, at that point, under 38.1.105.1, the judge has the authority to issue an instruction on the property.
Can I just ask an overall question which might help me? On the Sereni information, that is the only issue here that was subject to a motion in limine. Is that right?
That's correct.
The Willow Street was a decision made by the commission on its own.
That's correct.
Without prior instruction by the court, which the court then later disagreed with.
That's correct.
And
yep.
It was presented to the, talking about Willow Street now, it was presented to the commission as an evidentiary question, but the trial judge determined that it was a legal question.
That's right.
Can you tell me what the difference was, why the commission perceived it to be an evidentiary question and the trial judge subsequently found it to be a legal question, please?
Well, I can try. When we made the objection at trial, the Marshall Manufacturing case was offered to the commission as grounds for keeping the evidence out as a matter of law. And there was brief argument on
that. Okay, why did the commission at that point, what did the commission at that point say about hearing that issue as a matter of law?
I have the transcript.
They could have referred it to the trial judge even in the middle of the evidence for a ruling as a matter of law.
Judge Naves could have done that, and he did not.
But he ruled on it as a matter of law.
He ruled on it as a matter of relevance and found it was within the scope of direct.
Okay.
And then it went to the uniqueness of the property, as I recall. And he said he could separate that from its relationship to value.
Okay, so we allowed the evidence in, and then afterwards, the judge is responsible for coming up with some instructions, which are, of course, legal, and that judge decided not to allow that evidence in because it was inappropriate as a matter of law. Is that correct? That, and what was her reason?
So we presented to her, well, first of all, she had the top court briefing.
May I interrupt you on that question? I'm sorry. Did she acknowledge that the commission had ruled on it as a matter of evidence or not law?
I don't believe there was a distinction made on whether it was a matter of evidence or a matter of law. We described the situation and the objections made to her. We offered her Marshall Manufacturing and the other case law we had presented, and she said she had read Marshall Manufacturing. She was aware of the Colorado Supreme Court cases about evidence related to value, and then she decided she would issue the instruction. So she definitely had a legal...
Well, I'm reading along with you from the transcript, and then she goes ahead and says, that under the circumstances of this case, that evidence wasn't offered for that value. The transcript, I think, says that. You can check it, but I'm reading from it. So let's assume that I'm reading it correctly. She was, in fact, making an evidentiary ruling, wasn't she not? Not that it was inadmissible as a matter of law, but that as a matter of evidence, it was not relevant.
Well, she had a long explanation that I think started with the fact that she had read the Colorado Supreme Court cases that had been presented, and then I'm familiar with
what you said. I think based on all those cases, what the Supreme Court has determined is how you value what evidence can be taken into terms of valuing the property, and that under the circumstances of this case, this wasn't offered for that value. And yours are cutting it pretty thin as to whether that's law or evidence. But isn't she making a determination that for the purposes of this condemnation case, the evidence which was being offered as a matter of evidence was inadmissible or was not relevant with respect to the question of value?
I don't know what she was thinking in her ruling, but I think in terms of Marshall Manufacturing and the case we offered to her, which was related to value and value evidence, it said that there are two separate proceedings, and excluding evidence related to relocation was proper.
Here's where I'm trying to get. We have two situations which kind of taken together draw an interesting picture of what the commission did and what the commission did. I think what you're trying to suggest is that as long as it's evidence, the commission can go ahead and rule on either the serenity, or however you say the gentleman's name, evidence, but that if it's law, they can't, right?
Right.
And that's the bright line you want us to draw.
Well, I think the only bright line you have to draw relates to this particular denial of a motion limiting on relevance. But
well, with respect to the instruction on the real estate, though, we have to draw a bright line as well, don't we? Because if Judge Frick was subsequently making a ruling of evidence under the guise of an instruction, this question is a matter of law. Is that appropriate? Because she doesn't get to be both the judge and the partner.
I can't hear you very well.
She doesn't get to be both the judge and the commission. I mean, we do have to have some separation of duties, unless they're clearly delineating, unless the commission says, judge, we don't know how we're going to handle this particular situation. You be the judge. And the commission can do that either with respect to law or with respect to evidence.
It can do that.
But what the commission cannot do is rule on the law, right?
Pursuant to the statute, no, but I will say they do sometimes, and that is why the judge has to have the opportunity to instruct them what can be considered as a matter of law in instructions.
Okay, so is it your position that what they were doing is ruling, I'm talking about Willow Street, what they were doing is ruling on law, not evidence, when they decided to let that evidence in?
Well, what I'm saying is that particular evidence on relocation should not be considered as a matter of law, regardless of why the commission might think it's relevant, based on Marshall Manufacturing, the project influence rule, and the Fowler case that says you're valuing the property taken, not the property to which the property owner has moved.
Okay. Let me just come at it. I'll ask you one more question and I'll be done. Let me come at it from a different way. Do you want us to write an opinion that says commissions cannot rule on law. Only the judge can do that.
No, I want you to affirm the Court of Appeals decision that says that in this context, when the commissioners make a ruling on evidence that is inadmissible as a matter of law, the judge has the authority by statute to instruct them not to consider it so that we can continue to have checks and balances in these cases. But to your point, if an in limine ruling is not made on an issue as a matter of law prior to trial and it's in front of the commission and I object to it as a matter of law, they will make that ruling. And then it will depend if they're right or wrong as to whether you would ask the judge to instruct them differently. I mean, that's just as a lawyer, that is how it works.
Sure, I understand. So what you're basically suggesting, though, is that the only way we can have those checks and balances is to have basically two bites of the apple, before, during, and after commission proceedings on both evidentiary and legal issues. Is that right? I mean, you say that's how it works, and it probably is, but is that your position?
Depending on what you mean by two bites of the apple, yes. I think if there's an error
where the commission can then disagree, or issue either evidence or law brought up in front of the commission where the judge can disagree.
I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
A motion in limine prior to trial where the commission can disagree. Doesn't really matter, I guess, under your postulation, whether it's evidence or law. And something which is brought up in front of the commission, evidence or law, about which the judge disagrees later. Is that your position, that all of that is okay?
No, I don't. If the commission makes an evidentiary ruling that's based only on relevance and not on, if the commission left in evidence that as a matter of law can't be considered in the case, then yes, the judge should instruct the commission not to consider that evidence. If the commission makes a ruling on evidence, relevancy, credibility of the witness, and doesn't ask the judge to come in and make that ruling for it, then no, the judge shouldn't instruct the commission on that. Because the judge's authority is defined as instructing on the applicable and proper law.
Okay, so let me just circle back. I promised you one last question now. Forgive me. What is our holding? What does this case say? This case say, except do it however you want.
So affirm the decision that if an in limine ruling is made denying the request to exclude evidence based on relevancy or something else under the Colorado Rules of Evidence, and it's denied, that's left for the commission to determine in the context of the case, just like a civil court judge could do in the same case. And if the commission lessens something that can't be considered as a matter of law in a condemnation case, that the judge has the duty and the authority to instruct the commission not to consider that evidence in determining value, which is exactly what happened in this case.
But if the commission lets in something as a matter of evidence, which may or may not be appropriate legally, a 403 kind of a consideration, that's no longer fair game for the trial judge.
Not unless the commission asks, because that's what the statute says on that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Speaking of the statute, I'm kind of intrigued about this distinction between evidence and law that you all made. But let me just ask, so it looks to me like 105.2 seems, no, 101.2a seems to be very express that the commission can only rule on questions on the amount of compensation. So what's the rationale that anything having to do with evidence must be something, a question on the amount of compensation?
Well, frankly, within a commission trial, the only issue for the commission is valuation. And so in that context, they can rule on evidentiary things. But as I expressed before, and I shouldn't just say law, but rulings as a matter of law or questions of law, like non-compensable damages, loss of access, and those types of things that this court has said are not compensable, those rulings are outside of the commission's authority to decide.
Because they can never be questions on the amount of compensation?
Well, they're related to compensation, but they are issues that this board has said are not compensable as a matter of law. So a commission might like to give the landowner an award for something like loss of access, but as a matter of law, if there's not substantial impairment, they cannot make that award, and so the judge makes that decision ahead of time.
Okay.
Before my time runs out, I do want to address the harmless error piece because I think that seems to be a concern.
It's almost like you read my mind.
With regard to Jefferson Center Associates in the case that Mr. Duncan relies on, in that case, the evidence that was not let in and then the case was remanded for new trial was the highest comparable sale, and it was also central to the appraiser's opinion in that case of value. So it was in that context that it got remanded. Another example is the Blindview Story case, where there was a cost to construct a driveway and a driveway easement acquisition, and that cost was not admitted, and this court found that didn't wasn't cause for remand because the commissioners had heard valuation based on the comparable sales approach. So in this case, both sides offered appraisal testimony on the cost approach and the sales comparable approach. Nobody offered an income approach to that. Mr. Serrani testified he did not have an opinion of value. He was going to offer the average value of industrial properties under the income approach. So that is what the commission found to be irrelevant after 3 days of testimony. With regards to the Willow Street property evidence, it was not a comparable sale used by any of the appraisers. It was not a comparable lease used by any of the appraisers. It was the property to which the tenant, not even the landowner, moved to in relocation. And so these are not pieces of evidence that any of the appraisers relied on or were part of any of the valuation opinions in the case. They were pieces of evidence that RTD wanted to use to argue for less compensation for the property owner. And then that took us back to, you know, Marshall Manufacturing. That's why we don't let in relocation evidence to try to decrease compensation in a condemnation trial. That's why that evidence should be kept out. And on the Serrani evidence, that goes back to the founder irrevocable trust case. The landowner is compensated for the property he lost, not for the property to which he was forced to move, and to argue that should be the compensation he receives is contrary to that case. So there was no harmless error. I mean, there was no error. And if this court for some reason finds there was error, it was harmless in the context of these 3 days of testimony that the commissioners did hear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Duncan, you have a little bit of time left.
Thank you. My colleague, Mr. Rafine, pointed out a Supreme Court case that talks about evidence in the commission cases. It's the Goldstein versus Denver Urban Renewal Authority at 560 Pacific 2nd, 80, Colorado, 1977. It's in a footnote, however, and I'm not sure how they, I understand we're not supposed to use footnotes in a briefing or string sites, but this was in a footnote, so there's a Supreme Court case that addresses this. With regard to the Willow Street, we think it's let's have some common sense here. It's respectfully submitted. It's not reasonable to interpret the plain meaning of the statutes to give a trial judge the authority to rule on all issues and questions, and then to give the commission the ability to open the trial judge. That doesn't make sense. The judge both are important. Why file a motion? Let's step back and keep in mind here that counsel for the landowner filed the motion in limine. Counsel sought the ruling. It wasn't foisted on them. They affirmatively went forward to get a ruling motion in limine. So to the extent that they weren't happy with it, they waived their right. One way to look at it is they initiated the proceeding. Now they're complaining about the result. We don't think that's appropriate. The two bites at the apple. There has to be some certainty. Judge Goldberg, you're absolutely correct. I can tell you, I was a trial counsel. I was disappointed some of the Serenity evidence was eliminated, but I was counting on less of the Serenity evidence to be admitted because there was a court order for that effect. So we don't believe that a commission has the authority to overrule court. With regard to harmless error, again, the case law states that if you can't tell what the effect was on the instruction, what the effect of the instruction was, then you have to reverse. And again, the waiver issue, the landowner introduced the issue of relocation into the valuation file. On direct examination, they introduced the evidence. We took it further. The commission wanted to hear what we were taking it, and now they're complaining about relocation evidence being present in the congregation trial, and they were the ones who introduced it. Finally, the instruction, the Wilson instruction, and my remaining time, instruction number 16 states clearly, states, evidence regarding real property located at the Willis Street address in Commerce City is irrelevant. That's what is a matter of evidence. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Council, Mr. Duncan, Ms. Alderman. We are going to take about a 15-minute recess, I guess, to allow to get set up for the next case. So we'll be in recess for 15 minutes.